From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Gary Lilly.
Good morning to all of our troops on active duty on land, in the air, and at sea. You have our respect and admiration. Good morning to my veteran brothers and sisters. Welcome home. Good morning, America, and to all of the people in other countries who are listening in via the Internet. Good morning to all, and welcome to Veterans Radio, brought to you by Ave Maria Radio Studios here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Dale, good morning to you.
Good morning, above the finest.
Back in the studio is on the board is Dale Thornberry, the old slick pilot. I'm Gary Lilly, CB, can do, July 1966. Dale, the show this morning might be a little bit controversial to some people, and it's going to be about co-ed combat, the new evidence that women shouldn't fight the nation's wars. We're going to have the author, Kingsley Brown, with us. But right now you have some news, don't you?
I do, but it's fairly controversial. I want to make sure that people get our phone number and give us a call if they have a question or comment on that.
Please give it.
I will. That number is 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. Okay, for the news, a couple of interesting things going on. Of course, you know, Congress is trying to figure out a budget. Michigan is not the only one that's messing around with that. I got an email this morning from Paul Reichert, who is the head of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and we all agree that veterans should get the best care we can give them, but that isn't happening, and they need your help to change that. It's been almost 7 months since the crisis at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and yet a report released this week by the GAO, the investigative arm of Congress, found that the response by the President and Congress has been inadequate. They have done nothing to increase the benefits or budget expenses to Walter Reed and to the Department of Veterans Affairs at this time. The budget is supposed to be taken care of next week. So what Paul Reichert is asking is that you get on the phone or get on your emails and contact your congressman and let them know that you want this veterans budget passed and you'd like to get the increase that was proposed. So,
Dale, you know. They're trying to pay for other programs on the shoulders of veterans. And my gosh, the service that a peacetime veteran gives to this country, they're deserving of the very best.
Oh, I know. It continues on. The other story today, of course, is that shortfalls hobble guard units at home. And this is after 6 years of war. Some Army National Guard units are still struggling with less than half the equipment they need to do their job at home, a top guard general said on Wednesday. He said it will take an extra $13 billion over the next 5 years to get them back up to 90% of what they need. Come on, Congress, let's get going here. You're asking us to do, you know, what you want us to do. You got to give us the money to do it.
That's for sure. And people do need to contact their congressman and voice their opinion. They don't react unless people are calling them or writing handwritten letters.
It's absolutely true. And part of our mission statement is that we all have the political spectrum of the whole country, but the one thing we want is for our congressmen to just do what they promise to do. And if they don't, we're going to get rid of them.
There's a novel thought, keeping a promise.
Yeah, figuratively, I mean.
Oh, okay.
Oh, here's another. Boy, this money situation just keeps going on and on. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said on Thursday that he's inclined to improve an Army proposal for nearly $3 billion extra over the next 4 years to accelerate an expansion of its force. Army Secretary Paul Guerin said speeding up the growth of the force stretched thin by wars in Afghanistan would mean recruiting faster and increasing the numbers who reenlist. I'm probably going to recommend that they go ahead and give it a try. You know, all they got to do is
give it a try.
Give it a try.
Just give it the old college best.
Give it the college try. In fact, we're going to have a program coming up in the next couple of weeks on the GI Bill and how it has changed. And I got an email from there's a new book out there that talks about the GI benefits and how they compare to what they were in World War II and what they are today. And that they're really less today than they were, not taking into account inflation and all those other things. But the GI Bill used to pay your full tuition. Now they just give you a check, and you got to figure out how you're going to do it yourself.
Well, there's two sides to that argument. What occurs to me, I didn't know about the show, but what did it cost to go to the University of Michigan back in the 40s? And compared by inflation, what would it cost today? I'll bet you college is a little more expensive today.
I think it probably is. I'm thinking even when I went to the University of Michigan, I got my GI, I got a check every month for $400, which covered my expense, which covered the cost of going to school. So it's a great deal out there. I mean, I got a bachelor's and master's out of it, so it's a pretty good program.
Universities are real money machines.
Yeah. Yes, they are. And let's see. Finally, this is another one. Secretary of the Army Guerin says that Army funding crunch is coming. He says it's like calling the auto parts store and ordering a new battery, and you're not sure how you're going to pay for it. This is a situation that the Army finds itself given the funding delays imposed by Congress for the 2008 fiscal year that begins Monday. Army Secretary Pete Guerin said that he's frustrated that Congress is continuing to dither, on approving the money he needs to run the service, with some reports indicating lawmakers may not be able to approve a defense budget until January.
Are you feeling a little frustration back there?
According to my therapist, yes. I feel like I'm doing my Johnny Carson routine, or David Letterman, just throwing the news away after we get done with it.
Right. It doesn't quite work as well on radio, does it?
No, but people can't see my face.
I'll describe it for now. Arms are in the air, disgusted look on the face, papers flying over the shoulder.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Do we have? What about Welcome Home? Any troops coming home?
Gee, you think maybe? Here we go. Welcome Home. Each week on Veterans Radio, we welcome home servicemen and women who have been stationed around the world in the service of our country. And there's quite a few. And let me get started with my list here. There we go. Bravo Company of the 321st Engineering Battalion of the U.S. Army Reserves has returned home to Washington State. Welcome home to you folks. In Illinois, we've got the 33rd Military Police Battalion has returned to a great celebration at the Illinois State University campus in Normal. There was another great motorcade with the Patriot Guard leading the way.
Oh, God bless them.
To take them home, and it's just great that they got back. Again, that was the 33rd Military Police Battalion. We also want to welcome home the National Guard's 46th Military Police Unit that has returned to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan after more than a year in Iraq. 188 soldiers, including 60 from the UPers, was in an Iraqi training program that was training Iraqi police and security forces to be able to function on their own. The 46th Military Battalion lost three of their members in Iraq. But we welcome all the rest of them home. We grieve for the families of those fine men, really. The 399th Combat Support Hospital of the Maine National Guard has returned home, and they've been in Iraq for the last year. While in Iraq, this unit conducted hospital operations in both Al-Asad and Tikrit. The 399th established the first Army Combat Support Hospital in the Anbar province at Al-Asad. And a little bit closer to home, in Ypsilanti, just down the road from our studios here at Ave Maria Radio, the 1171st Area Medical Support Company returned home after 15 months in Iraq, and we're really happy that they are home. And on behalf of Veterans Radio, we want to make sure that we give you an official welcome home.
Welcome home. The Patriot Guard was there, as were Vietnam veterans, family, and members of the community. I understand it was a very nice welcome home ceremony, and nicer yet for the troops because it was very brief, and then they were able to scatter and be with their families and actually at home.
I think it's terrific. Welcome Home is sponsored by the Marine Scholars Program of Ave Maria University. Visit them online at avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. That's 239-280-2552. On behalf of Veterans Radio and a grateful nation, welcome home.
Attending Ave Maria University, By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
How many of you are suffering from some kind of chronic pain? If you are, then you're just one of millions of people our age who just live with it. I strongly suggest that you give Quantum Physical Therapy a call at 734-483-9200. Quantum Physical Therapy is a multifaceted facility providing cutting-edge conventional and alternative rehabilitation services. The highly qualified and friendly staff at Quantum are the movement experts and are committed to coming up with a specific solution for your specific problem. Whether it's pain, weakness, swelling, nerve injury, amputation, disease, or age-related morbidity, they can help you lead a productive life. Quantum Physical Therapy has two locations, one at 5417 Whitaker Road in Ypsilanti, and the other at 6180 Michigan Avenue in Saline. That's Quantum Physical Therapy, 734-483-9200, or on the web at www.qptherapy.com.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're coming to you from the Ave Maria Radio Studios in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This morning, the subject might be a tad controversial. There's people are going to be pretty firmly on each side of this position. We welcome Kingsley Brown, the author of a new book, Co-Ed Combat, The New Evidence That Women Shouldn't Fight in the Nation's Wars. Professor Brown, is that... how I'll refer to you. You're a professor of law at Wayne State University Law School. You're a clerk for Justice Byron White on the U.S. Supreme Court. You practiced law, labor law and employment law for 5 years, and now you're a professor of law at Wayne State University, specializing in employment discrimination and other aspects of employment law. Welcome, Dr. Brown.
Thanks very much, Gary. It's nice to be here. And feel free to call me Kingsley if you like.
Kingsley? All right, we'll do that. The book, I took a look at it, and I was reading it. This is a position that I think you've documented quite well. I'm amazed. There are 7 parts to it, and how many chapters, I don't know. But you have 18 pages of notes. They range anywhere up to, one of them is 71 notes for your for a chapter, and you have a 28-page bibliography. You did a little research for this. Let me ask you first, were you in the military?
No, I wasn't, Gary.
Okay. The book was dedicated to Frances Ann Brown, U.S. Navy, 1943-1945. Who would that be?
That's my mother.
That's what I suspected. Is she still living?
Yes, she is.
Oh, good. Maybe she's listening in today. What caused you to write this book?
Well, my background before I went to law school was in anthropology, and the physical anthropology, which involves the behavioral biological basis of human behavior, and I came to understand that there's a lot about our biology that affects how we act, and when I was in practice doing employment discrimination work, I saw that there were a lot of assumptions. For example, assumptions that men and women are basically the same that underlay a lot of the legal doctrines. So I got interested in sex differences and how they play out in various arenas. And my prior book called Biology at Work looked at the impact of sex differences on things like the glass ceiling and the gender gap in compensation. And this, in a sense, is an outgrowth of that, in the sense that I wanted to look at the occupational segregation, that is the tendency of men and women to do different kinds of work. And, well, there's one real area where there's a lot of occupational segregation, and that's in the military and especially in the combat forces.
And when it comes to national defense, I think this is a critical issue, and I think it's one that really needs open discussion. There is no open discussion, in my opinion, on this subject. There's a lot of opinions, but this is the first research that I've seen done on it. How did you research this book?
Well, a variety of ways. Primarily, as you mentioned, there's 30 pages or so of bibliography, so an awful lot of it was library kinds of research. I looked at a lot of studies on combat motivation, a lot of combat memoirs. I looked at a lot of the psychological literature on the biological basis of behavior, anthropological literature, and I also talked to quite a number of service personnel, both current and former, although I didn't do an empirical study in the sense that I wasn't trying to do a random survey of those people.
Did you do the research on your own, or did you have help?
No, it's all by myself.
That's a lot of reading. There are seven parts to this book and 22 chapters. Let's take them one by one. Part one, sex differences and their origins.
Okay. Lord Moran said that the art of command is the art of dealing with human nature. And I think that sort of as a background, it's important to note that in a sense, there are really two human natures, a male human nature and a female human nature. And there's a lot of overlap between the sexes, but there are also a lot of substantial differences. Everybody, I think, acknowledges that there are substantial physical differences between the sexes. Men are stronger, faster, have greater endurance. They have larger muscles and things like that. And so a lot of those differences are relevant in combat, especially ground combat, but not just ground combat, where strength is still quite important. A lot of people acknowledge this, but either discount the size of the differences or say that they can be made up with training. And that's really not true. There's very little overlap between males and females in upper body strength. If you take a male and female at random, there's something like a 95 to 99% chance that the male is going to be stronger than the female. And if you subject both males and females to physical training, what you tend to do is diminish that overlap. You increase the physical fitness of both groups, but you actually separate out the males and females more in terms of overlap. So there are the very large sex differences in physical capacity. Now, those, of course, are relatively easy to measure. There are also substantial sex differences in psychological attributes as well that are related to combat effectiveness. The men are much more willing to take physical risks, for example, to expose themselves to the risk of injury. You see that, you see it throughout the world. You see it in the sports, extreme kind of right. Recreation. And things like that. Men are much more inclined to use physical aggression, that is physical force against other human beings, and obviously risk taking and physical aggression are sort of the core of combat.
Now, anecdotally, anybody can back up an argument either side. People will talk about, well, look at the women that led an assault over in Iraq and were awarded the Bronze or Silver Star. Then again, I was speaking to a 12-year Marine officer who had just gotten out after 12 years, and he said in physical training, the women were so far behind, as an example on the running, in order to be able to show that they were able to keep up with the men, they were put to the front of the column, and the men were ordered not to pass them, so that they all finished at the same time. Do you think there's a lot of dishonesty in the way that this subject is approached?
Oh, and there's an incredible amount of dishonesty, and it's very disheartening because it makes it very difficult then to have an honest conversation because much of it is simply posturing. For example, after the first Gulf War, Secretary of Defense Richard Cheney was very complimentary to the women who served in the Desert Storm, as he should have, and said they served admirably. And then he went on to say, and we couldn't have won without them. Well, something like 6 or 7% of the personnel in the Gulf were women, and if our margin of victory was really that small, we're in bad shape.
That's typical of some of the comments when people are trying to be politically correct, I believe, and very few people believe that Dick Cheney is politically correct.
Right.
Part two, modern warfare. The nature of modern warfare, the special case for aviation. What can you tell us about that?
Well, one of the major arguments for inclusion of women in combat forces is that warfare has changed so much from ancient warfare, where it was virtually all male, that those lessons of ancient warfare no longer hold true for us. And that today warfare is a high-tech affair. It rewards brains and not brawn, and therefore the sexes are basically similarly situated with respect to warfare. But if you look at what goes on the ground, that simply isn't true. Our troops over in Iraq and Afghanistan engage in hand-to-hand combat. We try to avoid that as much as we can because we'd rather have overwhelming superiority, but at the end of the day, everybody has to face the risk of physical hand-to-hand combat. But even without hand-to-hand combat, you know, the guys over there, the infantry soldiers, are carrying 7,500 pounds on their back and humping it for miles sometimes. And that's extremely demanding physically. And that hasn't changed. The soldiers today often carry more than the soldiers of World War II and far more than ancient warriors carried, the tribal warriors that were always all men.
I'm always amazed to see the photographs over there in Iraq where they're wearing full battle gear, and they're wearing helmets and goggles and the flak jack. It's, you know, while they're doing physical work, like the Seabees. I was a Seabee. The first thing we did was strip down to our waist and went to work, and right now they're wearing everything, and I don't know how they do it.
Well, just their uniform, their body armor, helmet, their M16 or M4, and the ammunition they carry, that alone is about 60 pounds. That's not counting water, food, many of the other things they carry, batteries for all their high-tech equipment.
Grunts over in Vietnam, you see them, they never went out with just two canteens. Some of them would wear five canteens. That's a lot of weight. I know of the very minimal that they carried over there was about 45 pounds, but a lot of them carried up to 100 pounds. And I personally saw them going out carrying that much weight, so it's not a myth at all.
Sure, and you think of backpackers go out carrying 50 or 60 pounds, and they think they're carrying big loads, but then imagine you're carrying that, you double the weight, and then somebody starts shooting at you, and you have to get out of the way.
Yep, you've got to react quickly. The manliness of war. War is a traditionally masculine pursuit, what men fear and why men love war, the three chapters in part three.
Yeah, well, a lot of people now say that there's really nothing inherently masculine about war, that warfare is thought to be masculine because traditionally it was men, but those were the old days when you needed physical strength, which you supposedly don't need anymore. But the fact is that there are a lot of studies that show that that this masculinity of war is actually positively motivating. That is, if you ask men what it is that they fear going into combat, most men going into combat for the first time report the most common fear is that they'll chicken out. That they'll be cowards. And the thing that keeps them going is the fact that to fail in that respect is not to be a quote man. And the desire for the sort of self-view of people, of men, to be men, is actually very positively motivating, because the men often fear loss of respect of their comrades and loss of their respect as a man from showing fear, and that keeps them going. And of course, women don't have the same thing going for them. That is, they might have incentives to be good soldiers, but that's not quite the same as the core of being a man. As Samuel Stouffer, in his study of the American soldier in World War II, said the single code that most soldiers operated under was be a man. And showing fear and running away was to essentially violate that code.
So, and this is not your own opinion. This is based on research that you've done. How much research did you do on that particular subject?
Well, it's hard to quantify, but probably hundreds of hours. If you go through and read a lot of war memoirs, soldiers talking about what was going on, one of the great memoirs is E.B. Sledge's With the Old Breed. He was a Marine in World War II, and his take was pretty typical. He said, we weren't really that concerned about getting hurt. What we were really afraid of is that we would be cowards, and that we would disgrace ourselves in front of our comrades.
Okay, you mentioned the fear of people new to combat. What about the fear of people that had been in combat? Say, as a good portion of the troops that landed at D-Day in Normandy, there was a mixture of new guys and old guys, and the reason they had the new guys in the first wave is they didn't know what to expect and wouldn't hold back.
Right, and fear can be positively motivating or negatively motivating, and fear of bottling out in front of your comrades is positively motivated. It keeps you going. Fear of the other fears that men have, and especially men who have been in battle before, know that they can take it, or at least they think they can, and their fears are more likely to be of being either killed or often even more so being injured, permanently disfigured.
Right.
Those fears are, of course, negatively motivating. It's a reason to keep your head down. But we know that women are substantially more fearful than men of physical injury. And so you've got less in the way of positively motivating fear among women and more in the way of negatively motivating fear.
I mentioned this several times on the air on this show. Last year, I attended a triathlon that a young couple that I know entered. And it's probably 20,000 people were in this triathlon in Chicago. And I looked, and there were a lot of young men and a lot of young women missing an arm or a leg, a couple of people missing two legs. And I was stunned at that. And then I realized that we were just south of the Great Lakes Naval Hospital. So these were troops from Iraq, Afghanistan. And to see some of these beautiful young women missing an arm and a leg was just disheartening, Well, you can imagine what it does to you. Is your research showing that women are more fearful of that than men are?
Yes, they are, and also physical injuries to a woman are more devastating to the self. I mean, the fact is that we often judge, we meaning both men and women, judge women by their appearance, and those kinds of disfiguring kinds of injuries are more unsettling to women. They're unsettling to anyone, of course, but more so to women, and more associated with more psychological injury as well.
A little over a minute left. The chapter 10 is intriguing to me. Why men love war? What does that mean?
Well, there's this whenever the argument is made that. That it probably isn't a good idea to include women in combat. And one of the arguments, of course, is that no matter how few women you have to change a lot of the institution in order to accommodate them, and that it's hardly worth it because not very many women will probably be interested in engaging in combat, which is what seems to be the case. But then the response to that is, well, not very many men want to be in combat either. But the fact is that war holds a great appeal for many men, not all men. If it held a great appeal for all men, we wouldn't ever need a draft. When World War II broke out, American men went to Canada to join the armed forces. They went to England. And it just has a great appeal for many men, and there's something about men's psyche that makes it important.
Well, we've set it up, and right after this break, we're going to be coming back to the real meat of the subject and the physical differences. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Navy Captain James Stockdale inflicted a near-fatal wound to himself to show his willingness to die rather than divulge information. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Stockdale was recognized by the North Vietnamese as the leader in the prisoners of war resistance to interrogation and in their refusal to participate in propaganda exploitation. Sensing the start of another purge and aware that his earlier efforts at self-disfiguration to dissuade his captors from exploiting him for propaganda purposes had resulted in cruel and agonizing punishment, Stockdale resolved to make himself a symbol of resistance regardless of personal sacrifice. He deliberately inflicted a near-mortal wound to his person in order to convince his captors of his willingness to give up his life rather than capitulate. He was subsequently discovered and revived by the North Vietnamese, who, convinced of his indomitable spirit, abated in their employment of excessive harassment and torture toward all of the prisoners of war. Upon release from the captivity, he was promoted to Rear Admiral.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Pat the Handyman and his team is ready to help you with your remodeling, repair, and painting projects. Call Pat the Handyman at 734-260-1158. That's 260-1158. Pat the Handyman is a veteran-owned business.
Len Pitlack, CPA, is an award-winning consultant for the U.S. Small Business Development Center. Let him use his 25 years' experience to bring you, as an individual or small business owner, his professional and courteous tax and accounting services. Give Len Pitlack a call today at 734-993-1313.
Schrader Yacht Sales, the East Coast's finest dealer of Chris Craft, Island Packet Yachts, Packet Craft, Parker Fishing Boats, and Nautic Star Boats. Schrader Yachts is located at the top of Barnicot Bay in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Our good friend Ray Schrader provides you, the customer, with over 30 years experience in boat sales, sail and power boats, both new and used. Schrader Yacht Sales offers a full-service storage facility and a reliable crew responsible for all of your boating needs. Specialists in electronics, they can accommodate your needs for radar, autopilot, air conditioning, GPS, heat, and communications. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. That's 732-899-8010, or go to SchraderYachts.com. That's SchraderYachts.com. Oh, by the way, tell Ray you heard about him on Veterans Radio, and he will personally deliver your new boat from Schrader Yachts anywhere there's water. Schrader Yachts, ready to serve all of your boating needs.
And you're back on Veterans Radio, brought to you from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and live over the internet at www.veteransradio.net. We're talking to Kingsley Brown, whose book, Coed Combat, The New Evidence That Women Shouldn't Fight the Nation's Wars, will be coming out soon, I presume?
It's coming out November 8th, but it's available now for pre-order at Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
Amazon and Barnes & Noble. So get on the internet, I guess, and look it up. We're into the meat of the subject, I believe, right now. In part four of your book, Men and Women in Groups, The Bond of Brothers, All for One and One for All, Chapter 12, Who Men Follow, Leadership and Fellowship in Combat, and Chapter 13, The Evolved Nature of Male Bonding, Is Men's Aversion to Female Comrades in Arms Intractable? Tell us about those three chapters and what we'll find in them.
Okay, the many of the things that I've talked about so far involve individual differences between men and women, and they're measurable, whether a man's stronger than a woman, whether a woman maybe has more courage, although the psychological traits aren't particularly easy to measure. But individuals don't fight wars, groups do. And so the way groups interact is extremely important. And one of the staples of military doctrine for the last couple of millennia is the importance of group cohesion in combat, and what's the bonding of soldiers. Sometimes it's referred to as male bonding. And males and females enter into groups in different ways. Male groups tend to be larger. They tend to be more resistant to conflict. Female groups often are riven by conflict and can't really function very well if there's conflict between the members. But the importance of cohesion is pretty well established in terms of military effectiveness, and there's reason to think that including women in male combat groups will lower cohesion. In fact, there are a number of studies, many of them performed by psychologist Leora Rosen, looking at the effect of integrating women on the cohesion of the group. And one of the things that you find is the more women, typically the less cohesion in dangerous situations. And so, for example, she looked at groups in Somalia, in the Desert Storm, and in Haiti, and found that the more danger there was, for example, in Somalia, which was the most dangerous of those three places, the worse the impact of women on cohesion. So that's one problem. You mentioned the leadership and followership issue. You know, people who haven't been in the military often think that leadership is just outranking somebody, and you tell them what to do, and they do it. And in fact, it's very difficult sometimes to get people to follow orders, especially ones that are going to end up perhaps resulting in their deaths.
That's a fact. I can say that I saw that myself. I'm sure Dale saw it. He's nodding his head yes.
Yeah, and so the question then is who is it men will follow into combat? And you know, typically the combat leader is referred to as the old man, the father figure, even if he's actually younger than the men he right. leads. And there's a good reason to think that men will not follow women to the same extent. The soldiers typically identify in some respects with the man, with the leader, and it's much more difficult for male soldiers to identify with a female leader.
And in this part of the book, I've noticed that that's where you've got the most notes. These three chapters, you have 71, 42, and 54 notes respectively, indicating that these aren't simply opinions of yours, that you've researched them.
Yeah, this isn't just stuff that I made up or it came to me in a dream. There really are substantial effects of sex, and the last chapter in this section, as you mentioned, is raises the issue of whether the men's objections to women in combat are intractable. And it's certainly true if you ask men in combat groups whether they want women included, overwhelmingly they say no. The question then is, well, is this something they can be trained out of? Is it simply a question of teaching men that they should include women? And I think the answer is no. I think that, in fact, these objections probably are largely intractable, because I think that we've actually evolved to men, that is, to trust other men, but not all men, certain men in combat. And there are men who have attributes that women typically don't have.
Well, people have to earn trust, and they have to, the leaders in combat, I saw good and bad. I was not involved in combat. We were building fire bases for the Marines. And when you'd intermingle with them a lot while you were building this, and I heard the conversations amongst the troops, and there were sergeants that were dangerous, and there were sergeants that they would follow anywhere. And we had the same type of leadership in my unit. They did some things that even though they pushed us to the hilt, and there were times I didn't know if I was going to go on another day, I was so tired, I'd have done anything for those guys because of tremendous leadership. And so your premise, based on your research, is that women just can't get that position?
Well, the important thing, whether you're talking about comrades or leaders, is that the men trust them. And typically the trust doesn't just come. It is built up over time. It's one of the things that is the reason for much of the harsh training of soldiers. So they trust each other in a pinch. And if you look at the kind, you know, if you think about, you can think about the trust of comrades by analogizing it to preferences in mates. We have certain preferences in mates. We have preferences for men, have preferences for young, beautiful women. That's not going to surprise any of your listeners. Women have preferences for men with high status and control of resources. And these are for evolutionary reasons. So the reason that men have this preference for young, beautiful women is that, you know, that those are indicators of fertility. But we find young, beautiful women very attractive, even if we know they're on the pill, right? So it's the signs that women exhibit that would have been important throughout our evolutionary history, in terms of who would be a good mate. And the same thing is true with combat comrades. Men have to trust certain kinds of trust people with their lives, and over the course of probably hundreds of thousands of years, men have gotten together in groups and engaged in dangerous activities, whether warfare or hunting, and would have evolved similar kinds of mechanisms to decide who they can trust and who they can't. A study of Korean War soldiers found that the two most important attributes of people who were found to be effective fighters were masculinity and leadership.
In the aversion, I've lost my. I was listening to you and forgot my question. So let's just go on. Do you think that men are more protective of women in dangerous situations to the danger of the other people involved?
I think that they clearly are. Men have a tendency generally to attempt to protect women. We expect it. We expect if a couple is assaulted by some sort of bad guy or bad guys, that it will be the man who will defend the woman. And sometimes taking too many steps to protect one of your comrades can be very dangerous and destructive to the mission.
And of course, this is anecdotal. My brother served in the Army, but lived in Pensacola, Florida, where there's five military bases, Navy, Air Force. And right after that aircraft went down on the island controlled by the Chinese, one of our spy planes.
Hainan, yeah.
Right. What all the talk was amongst the retired personnel there was radio transmissions that went back and forth where they were ordered to ditch that plane. That was part of the procedure they were to do. But they responded that there was a lady on board and they wouldn't ditch it. They were going to land on that island. Now, people can debunk that, but apparently that was the conversation, you know, throughout. And I just think it's natural. One of the things in the Gulf War, there was a female helicopter pilot taking a prisoner, and people point to that and saying, look how well she handled it. But what nobody picked up on was the 19-year-old boy soldier, I call him a boy, it was a man, who, when they started slapping her around, he jumped in to defend her and was nearly killed because of that. I truly believe that it's just part of our makeup that men will put themselves in danger to protect women.
Well, it is, and that's actually one of the reasons that the Israeli Defense Force, which has the mistaken reputation of having always included women in combat, excluded women from combat positions from the very founding of Israel, because during the war for independence, one of the things that they found was that men would take unnecessary, inappropriate risks to protect their female comrades. And Gary, let me say one thing about, you raised the issue about that EP-3 plane going down in Hainan. if you read the description of what the pilot had to do to keep that plane under control, you'd understand that that physical strength is very important even in aviation.
Well, anybody that's ever shaken hands with a fighter pilot knows that there's a lot of physical strength required. We're coming up on a break right now. We're with Kingsley Brown, author of Co-Ed Combat, The New Evidence That Women Shouldn't Fight the Nation's Wars.
Gary Lilly & Associates is now Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates, the newest Michigan affiliate of a leader in the commercial real estate industry, Sperry Van Ness. More than 800 Sperry Van Ness advisors in 136 markets sold nearly $11 billion in commercial real estate last year. That was done by putting the client's interest first, thereby generating maximum return for every property. When we list a property, we immediately place it on 6 internet commercial listing services and email it to 40,000 prospective buyers and 60,000 commercial brokers. We offer to split the commission 50-50. That means your interests, not ours, are placed first. To learn more, call Sperry Van Ness Lilly & Associates Commercial Realtors at 800-345-6694. That's 800-345-6694. Be advised, there is a difference.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, brought to you from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with Kingsley Brown, author of Co-Ed Combat, The New Evidence That Women Shouldn't Fight the Nation's Wars. You know, before we go any further with this, there's a lot of women out there serving in the military right now. This book is not intended to diminish or undermine their position and what they're doing, is it?
No, and I make that clear, in, I think, in several places throughout the book. I think that the nation should be grateful for their service, and it's not a arguing that women shouldn't be in the military. It's arguing specifically that they should be excluded from combat and related positions. But again, that's not necessarily because of anything about women, but it's the way men and women interact often that, that causes the problem.
And you're questioning some of the decisions being made by our leadership, and we're going to get into that part right now. Part five, threats to cohesion and effectiveness arising from the mixing the sexes. Chapter 14, we already covered who men protect, women and children first. Sexual Relationships and Attraction, Chapter 15. And Chapter 16 is Double Standards and Political Correctness. I think right there in 15 and 16 are some of the things that the sexual relationships and attractions, there's a lot of statistics that are probably going to be surprising to some people, pregnancies and such.
Right, absolutely. And I actually have a separate chapter on pregnancy, but we talked before about cohesion and the importance of groups cooperating, and one of the problems when you take mostly male groups and put in a couple females is all of a sudden they're not cooperating so much anymore. They're competing against each other for the attentions of women, and you'd like to say, well, they shouldn't do that, but they're human and often isolated from their loved ones, and it's fairly normal that there would be some sexual relations occurring.
And there can be harsh penalties. I recall specifically at the time that the president of the United States was going through a sex scandal, there was one case in a camp in the Army where the sergeant had sexual relationships with a private female, and they were consensual, and he was sentenced to 25 years in of hard labor. The reason being the decision saying that when you have a difference of power, power such as that, there's no such thing as consensual. I can see where that type of a decision may enter into a morale. But is that something that you found?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're referring mostly to the Aberdeen scandal. But yeah, for one thing, it always treats the woman as the victim. No matter whether she, as in some of the Aberdeen cases, was actually the initiator of the sexual relations, but to say that, well, she can't even give consent, it really is to treats the women sometimes as children. And one of the talking about double standards, one of the consistent problems is that whenever there's sexual misconduct, the man, almost always the man, is punished substantially greater than the woman. You know, in the Tailhook scandal, there were a lot of quite a number of female officers who had engaged in some of the same misconduct that ruined the men's careers, and not a single woman was disciplined for misconduct.
Well, that gets into part six, special problems resulting from female personnel, chapter 17, rape of female prisoners of war, and chapter 18, reproductive issues, pregnancy, motherhood, and hygiene. Oops, the political correctness part of it was the one that I was looking for. That was chapter 16. Let's touch on the political correctness before we get into part six.
Well, part of the political correctness I just mentioned, which is the differential treatment of men and women with respect to sexual misconduct kinds of issues. But the real core problem of political correctness is that you can't have a reasoned conversation in the military about women if you're not completely on board for women everywhere. As one naval officer told me, you'll never make flag rank. That this is simply a test. And one, so that the Pentagon typically covers up problems with women. To talk about pregnancy, you'd think that in Iraq, when there's so many women serving and a lot of women getting pregnant, that the Army would want to know how many women are being sent home because of pregnancy. And if you ask Central Command, as some reporters did, they were told, we're not keeping track of that. Well, I don't believe that for a minute.
And you mentioned also that there was, have there been one or two or more cases of women actually delivering babies on board naval ships?
Yeah, there's one case, one woman who delivered a baby on a warship. A number of women on other kinds of ships have delivered babies, and you know, obviously, pregnancy and deployment are viewed as being inconsistent. So when it comes time for deployment, if women are pregnant, they can't be sent. And if they're deployed, they get pregnant, they have to be sent home.
If it's critical positions, I guess we have enough people to replace them. But also that there goes the cohesiveness. When you train with one person, then they're replaced. It's like starting all over again from scratch.
And a lot of times, actually, they're not even replaced. A woman gets pregnant for the first few months. In many cases, she's still on the job, but she can't do many of her tasks. She can't fly, perhaps. She can't be around any kind of harmful chemicals. But she still counts against the unit's numbers. And so it's not like they actually bring somebody in and replace them. A lot of times, they're simply short-staffed, and the people in the unit have to pick up the slack.
Well, let's skip way ahead to chapter 21. Why comparisons to some other forms of discrimination are unpersuasive?
Yeah, one of the common arguments that's made with respect to all sorts of discrimination is, well, this is just like race. You know, people, we used to keep blacks out of the military, or at least had them segregated. And this is the same the same kind of thing, and the arguments about cohesion and the arguments about effectiveness were sometimes made with respect to integration of blacks, and therefore this is the same thing. And well, but it's not the same. There are biological differences between blacks and whites, but those aren't related in any way to combat effectiveness. That is, the social distinctions that we make between blacks and whites are what was important. Here, the difference between men and women isn't a social distinction. It's a biological distinction. And I think that the analogy to racial discrimination is much weaker than the analogy to age discrimination. We don't let 50-year-old men enlist in the military, and nobody seems to think that that's a problem. But why don't we? Well, because they're likely to be injured more. They're perhaps not as aggressive as young men. They have more health problems. But all this, those things are true of women as well. And we don't think it's morally problematic to exclude 50-year-olds. I'm not sure why it's necessarily morally problematic to exclude women.
Supposing your arguments were accepted by everyone, is there any way that this could be reversed, in your opinion?
Well, if it were accepted by everyone, it could.
Well, there you go. By the majority.
I mean, there's obviously a lot of resistance to anything having to do with sexual equality for many of the political correctness reasons you mentioned. Many people tell me, oh, yeah, I wish people would admit this, or I've always felt this way, but I've been afraid to say it. These are military people because they know that it would end their careers.
And you have talked to a lot of military people in your research for this book?
Quite a number, and one thing I should say, in case there are people out there thinking that I'm hostile to women in service, and that is that almost really overwhelmingly, men have good things to say about women in the military. But most of the men that I talked to were against having women in combat units, but they're very positive on the contribution that women make to the military.
And when we get into a war like Iraq, Vietnam was the same way. There's no lines. The lines of communication are, meaning the convoys, are extremely vulnerable to ambush. There is no way that women cannot be in combat if they're doing the jobs like driving trucks and things of that nature.
That's right, and I think that that's a good reason for not putting them in those positions. The argument that there aren't any front lines anymore, first of all, is wrong. As you note, the same thing was true in Vietnam, but we don't really think we should have been sending women into Vietnam, and so that part isn't new. And the other part is the argument is usually raised to say, well, so women should serve everywhere, do everything, because there are no lines. Well, another response would be to take them out of the war zone to the extent that they're exposed to combat risks.
Was there a driving reason with you as to why you wrote this book? Is it a national defense, or trying to for lack of better words, right or wrong, or what was your motivation?
Well, it's always hard for us to say exactly what our motivation is for anything, but I think that it is an important national defense issue. I think that the only criterion that should be used to decide whether and where women serve should be national defense, and issues of social equality, social justice, and so forth, I think have to take a back seat. I think national security is imperative.
Dr. Kingsley Brown, author of Co-Ed Combat, The New Evidence That Women Shouldn't Fight the Nation's Wars, available now on Amazon and Barnes & Noble online.
Yes.
And coming to a bookstore near you. Thank you so much for being on Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
Dale, what do we have coming up next week? We don't know. Tune in for the surprise show. We would like to thank our sponsors, Marine Scholars Fund, Quantum Physical Therapy, Legal Help for Veterans, Len Pitlack, CPA, Schrader Yachts, Sperry Van Ness, Lillian Associates, and Pat the Handyman. When you're hiring somebody, hire a vet.
That's for sure. We also want to remind people, if you have some story ideas that you'd like to give us, send us an email at veteransradio.net, and we'll be happy to get that program on the air.
And in the meantime, from Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of our guests and are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.